On this edition of Celebrating Science, Professor Ben Schumacher on the physics of impossible things. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit, scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, The Physics of Impossible Things, Dr. Schumacher will show how the laws of physics establish a boundary between possibility and impossibility. He will also share some surprising connections between the two. Dr. Schumacher is a professor of physics at Kenyon College in Ohio. He received his PhD from the University of Texas in 1990. He is widely regarded for his work in the area of quantum information and is often credited with coining the term qubit. Among his many honors, Dr. Schumacher is the recipient of a prestigious Rosenbaum Fellowship from the Isaac Newton Institute for Mathematical Sciences.
Physicists usually talk about possible things. It makes sense because our job as physicists is to understand this universe. It turns out that physicists from time to time find it very useful and enlightening to talk about impossible things. And in so doing, I hope to show you that we're going to learn some very important things about the laws of the real universe, about the way the universe really works. The first thing I want to do is I want to distinguish between at least three different meanings for the word impossible. The first thing I might mean is what you might call absolute impossibility. Absolute mathematical impossibility, like 1 = 0, or some kind of logical contradiction that a chair has 4 legs and a chair doesn't have 4 legs at the same time. Just a contradiction in terms. And this is absolutely impossible. This is something that you can say, yes, the chair has 4 legs and the chair does not have 4 legs, but you don't really mean anything by that. What we want to talk about is something which we could call relative impossibility. And this is something that is impossible given some reliable assumptions about the way the world is. And so if those assumptions are true, then things are impossible. So we'll talk about the fact that you can't go faster than light. And that depends on our knowledge of physical law. And that knowledge, of course, is always provisional. So when I say that that's impossible, I mean it's impossible relative to are reliable assumptions. That's the kind of impossibility that's usually involved in physical impossibility. And then there's the third kind, which is related to the other two, we might call effective impossibility. These are things that aren't really impossible, but they're really unlikely. Well, if I flip a coin 1,000 times, it's a fair coin, it's possible I could get heads every time. That's possible. The probability isn't zero, but the probability is so close to zero that you should feel quite comfortable betting all your money that it won't happen. Okay? It's effectively impossible. Now, the difference here really is the difference between this kind of impossibility where we cannot imagine things to be otherwise. We cannot imagine a world that contains actual logical contradictions, as opposed to these over here, where we can imagine things otherwise. We could imagine that the laws of physics as we understand them are wrong. We could imagine that we would get 1,000 heads in a row if we flip the coin. We could imagine that. So this is an important distinction. And it is important to imagine because sometimes these things over here, sometimes when we change our understanding of the world, we find that these things actually are otherwise. Maybe our assumptions are going to get changed. This happened in physics a little over 100 years ago with the introduction of relativity and quantum theory, and the boundary between what we thought was possible and impossible shifted around in interesting ways. Okay, so three kinds of impossible. That's to get us started. So the first kind of impossible things I want to talk about will be the sorts of things you might see in science fiction movies. So we want to talk about going back in time and going faster than light. Let's talk about time travel first. Time travel. You know the idea of time travel. We have a time machine. Mine's not as elegant as the one that was on the slides before, but this is the time machine. You get into the time machine, and it will take you from 2008, maybe forward in time to 2108, 100 years forward in time. Or the time machine might take you back to 1908, 100 years ago. It transports you to another time. Now, of course, such machines are possible. At least those are possible. It's perfectly easy to make a machine that does that. You just get in it and you wait around for 100 years and then you come out. If you don't like just waiting, then you can, the various ways you can imagine shortening the subjective time. You could fly around very fast near the speed of light or go sit near a black hole or something like this. All of these are possible in principle, and that's all we're really considering. So going that way is possible. The impossible one is this one, going back in time. Well, why do we think that time travel is impossible? Well, the reason is that if you can do time travel, then that opens up some paradoxical potentialities. And the most famous one is called the grandfather paradox. Okay, so here we are now. I get into my time machine. I go back in time. My time machine arrives. I leave the time machine. But wait, what's that in my hand? There's my grandfather in front of me. Before he married my grandmother, I have a gun. And I shoot him. And now that my grandfather is dead, he can't marry my grandmother. They can't have children, and so I will never be born. So if I'm never born, how was it that I got in the time machine to go back in time and shoot my grandfather? I guess he's safe. But of course, if he's there, then eventually I'll get a time machine and I'll go back in time and shoot him. You can see the problem. It's a paradox. It's a paradox. I can't make everything consistent. This is really close to one of those mathematical, logical impossibilities. The grandfather paradox and its cousins are the reason we don't think that time travel is possible. Or if we have a theory that tells us that time travel might be possible, we start worrying a lot, and we want to find out what's going on in our theory. And I want to tell you about a related idea, which we'll call the telegraph paradox. That was the grandfather paradox. This is the telegraph paradox. And the idea is that I have a machine that doesn't let me travel back in time, but lets me send a message back in time, a time telegraph. So I can take the machine now, and I can send a message back to yesterday. That's how it works. This machine is a problem. Why? Because if I had such a machine, I could set up the following diabolical experiment. I'm going to send a message back in time on Wednesday, if and only if no message arrives on Tuesday. That's the plan. Okay, right? So let's suppose that Tuesday comes and no message arrives, so I go to Wednesday arrives, I send a message back to Tuesday. But that means a message must have arrived on Tuesday. Because we're assuming the time telegraph works. And if the message arrives on Tuesday, that means I'll know, don't send a message on Wednesday. And around and around you go. It's the same problem without the bloodshed. The telegraph paradox is really the reason that we don't think you can send messages back in time. It's not a question of traveling back in time. Sending messages would be bad enough. It's really all about the information. It's really all about sending information back in time. Let's move on to something else impossible. Let's talk about a famous speed limit, the limit of the speed of light. Rather famously, because of relativity, nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. And the speed of light is about 299,792 kilometers per second, which is pretty fast, but it's the limit. It's the limit. Nothing can travel faster than that. Well, I say nothing can travel faster than that. Of course, that depends on what you mean by a thing. So consider a pair of scissors. Well, imagine that these are extremely large scissors that, you know, extend over maybe interplanetary distances. And I want you to pay attention to a particular point here. And my graphics it's not going to be that good, but just follow along here. I want you to pay attention to the intersection point between the blades of scissors, the point where the blades meet together, the point where the cutting is done in the paper. And now I'm going to move the blades toward each other. They won't move exactly like scissor blades, but the idea will be the same. I'm going to move them toward each other like so, and watch the point of intersection. Okay, let's do that again. Okay, now first, go back and watch the scissor blades. They're not moving very fast. They're moving vertically here. They're not moving very fast. But the point of intersection zips across horizontally very fast, much faster than the blades themselves move. And if you made big enough scissor blades, and the angle between them was small enough, and you move them together fast enough, the point of intersection could exceed the speed of light. So evidently, the point of intersection of a pair of scissor blades doesn't count as a thing. Okay? It's just like saying, oh, I'm thinking about Mars, and now I'm thinking about Saturn. Has my attention moved faster than light? No, that's the wrong way to talk. The thing I'm thinking about is not actually there. It's not a thing. The object of my attention, in the same way that an electron is a thing. So the scissors effect here tells us that we have to be careful about what we call a thing. Now, every so often, you read in the paper a story that says scientists have caused a laser pulse to travel 100 times faster than light. So what's that all about? A laser pulse sure sounds like a thing, right? That's pretty tangible. So let's talk about that. Here's a light pulse traveling through space, and let's have it go through empty space. It moves at the speed c, and after a certain length of time, it winds up over there. Moves at a speed c. But let's suppose instead we send the light pulse through an ordinary medium, like a piece of glass or water or something. It goes through there. The speed of light in the medium turns out to be slower than the speed of light in a vacuum, in empty space. And so the light pulse, after the same length of time, hasn't quite gotten as far. In fact, it can be a lot less than this. In water, for example, it only moves at 75%. Visible light only moves at 75% of the speed it moves in empty space. And of course, another thing that might have happened is the medium might have dispersed the colors, so this pulse might get kind of misshapen. But the point is, it arrives later. It hasn't gone as far in the same amount of time. But it turns out there's a trick you can play with what we might call an anomalous medium. This is actually a phenomenon called anomalous dispersion, and the details are interesting but irrelevant for us. And what can happen is I can send the pulse in, and two things happen to the pulse. One thing is that its speed changes, but another thing is the pulse gets shorter. And at the far end, the pulse looks like this. Now look at the center of the pulse. The center of the pulse, where the energy is mostly. The center of the pulse is actually farther to the right than the empty space pulse. So the center of the pulse, in some sense, has moved faster than the speed of light. So is relativity wrong? Have we disproven it? No. No, there's something else you should be paying attention to. That something else is the leading edge of the pulse. The leading edge of the pulse through a vacuum has gotten all the way to here, but the leading edge of this narrower pulse hasn't gone as far. The leading edge cannot go faster than light. It's the leading edge that matters. Why? What's at the leading edge? Well, I'll tell you what's at the leading edge. What's at the leading edge is news. The news that there's a light pulse coming, right? It's all about the information. The speed of light is the maximum speed of information transfer in the universe. The information can't go faster than the speed of light. All kinds of other things you can play games with, but information, that's the thing that's limited by the speed of light. Okay, well, I said it's limited by the speed of light. Let's see why. Why can't we send faster than light signals? Why can't Alice and Bob have a sort of a gizmo that lets them send signals from Alice to Bob faster than light? Why couldn't that be true? Why couldn't we have one of these things? Well, I'm going to tell you. You're going to actually find out the reason. Why is this impossible? In order to find out the reason, we're going to have to think about relativity. We're going to have to think about space-time. We're going to have to think in space-time. What is space-time? Well, space-time is the four-dimensional world we live in. If you wanted to meet somebody, you would tell them, you know, your latitude, longitude, and altitude that you want to meet them. That's three numbers. But you'd also tell them what time of day you want to meet them. That's a fourth number. You need four numbers to specify a point in space and a moment in time. And so space-time is nothing besides the collection of every point in space at every moment in time, all thought of as one big four-dimensional world. And that four-dimensional world is the arena of physics. It's where everything that happens physically happens in space-time. So I need to think about space-time. In fact, I need to draw space-time up here. It's a two-dimensional screen. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pretend that space is one-dimensional too. There's one dimension of space, one dimension of time. So I'm going to have some axes here, okay? Time goes up, and space goes sideways. And I'm going to graph things. For example, suppose I have a particle, just a particle sitting at rest. What does that look like in space-time? Is it just a point? No, because the particle exists at many times. But if it's at rest, it's always in the same place at different times. So we have what's called the world line of a particle, and it looks like this. Here's a particle at rest. It's just sitting there, and so at every moment in time, it's at the same place in space. Okay? Well, suppose the particle is moving. Suppose it's moving off to the right. It's moving to the right, and so at later and later times, it's a little farther to the right, and so its world line is tilted in space-time. Okay? Suppose you had a particle that was moving from side to side. It's going like this. What would the world line look like? Well, it would look like this. Move one way, then it'd move the other way. The motion in space is just back and forth, but in space-time, it's a wiggly curve like that. So this is how you have to think about particles in space-time. They have world lines. If you had a particle, like a photon, moving at the speed of light, its world line would be tilted over at a particular angle at a maximum speed c, and no particle's world line could be tilted at a greater angle. So that's how to think in four dimensions. Now I want to tell you the second most important and famous result of the theory of relativity. The first one, of course, is the equivalence of energy and mass. But the second most important one is a fact about clocks, that moving clocks run slowly. So what does that look like in space-time? Okay, here's our space-time, right? Space is side to side, time goes up. And let's imagine a clock just sitting here at rest. Here's the clock. Here's the world line of the clock. What are these dots on the world line? Well, it's a clock, so it's ticking. So these dots are the points on its world line, the moments of time where it's going tick, 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 tick. This, in space-time, it looks like this. Okay? It turns out that if you have a moving clock, its world line is tilted because it's moving. But it turns out that the dots here, the ticks of the clock, are more widely spaced in the same interval of time in which this thing goes through three complete ticks, this only goes through two. This is a funny looking picture. What's wrong with the moving clock? Nothing's wrong with it. It's working perfectly well. In fact, it's equivalent to the other clock. It's physically just as good as the other clock. And in fact, in space-time, this is the weird part. This is the part that's hard to swallow. In space-time, this distance is the same as this distance. The reason it doesn't look the same is that this isn't space-time. This is a picture on a projection screen, which is space-space. Okay? All right? And the laws of geometry in space-space are just a little bit different than the laws of geometry in space-time. And so the laws of geometry in space-time are, that's one second also. Okay, so moving clocks. So where am I going with this? Well, let's do an experiment. We're gonna imagine that Alice and Bob can send signals faster than light to each other, and we'll see what the consequences are. Okay, here's space-time, and we're gonna arrange it like this. In this view of space-time, Alice is at rest, Bob is moving to the right, therefore Alice's clock is ticking along like this, Bob's clock is ticking along more slowly. In fact, Bob's clock is running, it looks like half the speed, because at the same moment of time, that would be a horizontal line, that Alice's clock reads 2, Bob's clock only reads 1, 4, 2, and so on. So Bob's clock appears to be running 2 times more slowly. All right, and so what Alice is going to do is sometime, let's say at moment number three, Alice is going to decide to send a message to Bob faster than light. And it goes faster than light so that the angle of the line I draw is more than it would be for the speed of light. And so when Alice's clock reads 3, she sends a faster than light message to Bob. It reaches Bob when his clock reads 2. That already sounds a little suspicious, but let's keep going. Okay, that's what happens. And let's assume that can happen. Well, let's look at this from Bob's point of view. In Bob's point of view, it looks like this. He's at rest, Alice is moving to the left. From Bob's point of view, Bob's picture of space-time, his clock is running at a normal speed, and Alice's clock is running slowly. This is consistent, but it's a little weird looking. And then that message looks like this. It's a message back in time. If the message looks like it goes back in time from Bob's point of view. In fact, they can do this. Bob gets the message at time 2 on his clock. Then he just remembers it until time 3. Then he sends it back using the same technique Alice used, and it gets to her at time 2. The net effect, using Bob as a relay, Alice can send a signal into her own past. And now you have the possibility of the telegraph paradox. And because the telegraph paradox is bad, we don't think you can send signals faster than light. We think that's an upper limit to the transfer of information. And of course, information is the problem, because the telegraph paradox relies only on sending information. It's all about the information. Let's move on to some quantum impossibilities. These are things you may never have heard of. In fact, these are things that have not been the subject of big-budget Hollywood blockbuster science fiction movies, which, speaking as a quantum physicist, is really too bad. But there's a quantum impossibility. Let's talk about quantum impossibilities. Of course, I'm going to have to tell you some quantum physics first. We'll just talk about one particular piece of quantum physics. We're going to talk about photons. We're going to talk about particles of light. And photons have a property called polarization, which is a direction in space perpendicular to their direction of propagation, which tells you, if you think of light as a wave, it tells you the direction of the disturbance in the electromagnetic field associated with the light wave. Okay, so the disturbance in the electromagnetic field is transverse, is perpendicular to the direction of propagation. Remember that, it'll come back later. Okay, now. All right, so let's talk about it. What kind of polarizations can you have? You can have lots of different polarizations, but I want to focus on 4 in particular. You can have it be horizontally polarized or vertically polarized. The light could be diagonally polarized this way or diagonally polarized that way. Now, it turns out that a very common item are polarizing filters. These are filters that allow one kind of polarization to go through and block the perpendicular polarization. So for example, let's suppose I have a polarizing filter that's oriented in the vertical direction, and let's send a vertically polarized photon through. What happens? Well, the vertically polarized photon goes right through 100% of the time. I simplify. That's all right. Okay, well, what if we send a horizontally polarized photon through it? Well, then that photon is always blocked. 100% of the time, it's blocked. In fact, this is how polarizing sunglasses work. The reflected glare off of horizontal surfaces tends to be horizontally polarized. You put some vertical polarizers in front of your eyes, the glare light is preferentially removed. This is how it works. Okay, it's all quantum mechanics. So, they should market them as quantum sunglasses. That would be good. Okay, I should copyright that idea right away. Okay, so what happens now? I know you're asking this question. What happens if you send What happens if you send a diagonally polarized photon through? Well, if it gets through, it's got to be vertically polarized. And if it doesn't get through, you assume it's got to be horizontally polarized, but it's neither. What happens? Well, what happens is 50% of the time one happens and 50% of the time the other happens. It's random. It's probabilistic. This is the fundamental probabilistic nature of quantum mechanics. That sometimes it does one, sometimes it does the other. You can't predict which one's going to happen. And what this means is that if a photon comes along and it sneaks through your vertical polarizer, you can't tell for sure if it's vertically polarized. If you knew it was either vertical or horizontal, you could tell it had to be vertical. But you can't tell. Maybe it was diagonally polarized and it got through anyway. That's possible. What that means is that you couldn't use one of these polarizers to tell for sure exactly what the polarization was before you measured it. And in fact, that's a general fact about quantum mechanics, that no device can reliably distinguish all four polarizations. There's no perfect polarization analyzer, which I have trouble saying, so I'm going to call it a PPA. There's no device that can tell all four of these apart perfectly. Well, of course, anytime you make a statement like this, you want to say, oh yeah, but suppose you had an impossible device. How could I violate this? How could I try to build such a device, a perfect polarizing analyzer? Well, one way would be to use an amplifier. So let's take a photon. I have a device, a perfect quantum amplifier, an ideal quantum amplifier. Along comes a photon. And what this does is it takes that photon and it makes lots of photons exactly the same polarization. And if I send a diagonal polarized photon through, it makes lots of those, and so on. Whatever polarization I send in, one photon, I get a million photons out the back end with the same polarization. And if I had such an amplifier, I could take those million photons and I could send it through a vertical polarizer. And if the photons were all vertical, they'd all get through. But if they were all diagonal, some would get through and some would not. And I'd be able to tell for sure at the far end whether I had this situation or that situation. And so I'd be able to tell apart the vertical and diagonally polarized photons. The net result is that if I can make an ideal quantum amplifier, I can make a PPA, a perfect polarization analyzer. So what? Well, it turns out that it's a very important principle of quantum mechanics that you can't do this, that there's something called the quantum no-cloning theorem. So the idea of quantum cloning is this. I've got some unknown photon of unknown polarization and some other photon that's in some standard polarization. I think of that as blank paper for my copying machine. This is truly a photocopying machine. Okay, right? And then out of this machine comes two perfect clones of the original one. Can I have a machine like that? The answer is no. The laws of quantum mechanics, in a very straightforward way, completely exclude the possibility of such a machine. And that's a remarkable fact. It's also remarkable that such a fundamental principle of quantum theory, I think one of the most important principles in quantum theory, was discovered after quantum theory had already been around for more than 50 years. So that raises two questions. Nowadays we say that quantum information cannot be perfectly copied. That's what this means. It's all about the information, actually. So now it raises two questions. One of them is, how did anybody think of this? The other one is, why didn't they think of it before? And let me tell you the answer to the second one, which is easier to answer. Because it's hard to answer why people didn't think of something. There are lots of reasons. They were thinking about other things. They were busy. It never occurred to them. Okay, the reason they were thinking about this in the late 1970s is because of the following. It's because of quantum entanglement, which is another cool thing about quantum mechanics. Okay, so here's the story. We've got Alice and Bob with their polarizers, and we have a device that produces pairs of photons. And we can arrange this to produce the pairs of photons in a situation so that, and this is a special case, but it's possible to make this, so that if you make the same measurements on both sides, it always leads to opposite results. So if Alice has her polarizer vertical and Bob has his polarizer vertical, then if the photon gets through this one, the other photon will be blocked. And if a photon is blocked by this one, the other photon will get through. The results are always opposite. If this photon turns out to be vertical, that one turns out to be horizontal and vice versa. And that's true no matter which angle you put the polarizers at. Okay, so this is kind of cool. Let's think about it. Let's just think about what Bob sees, what's coming at Bob. And let's suppose Alice set her polarizer vertically. And remember, Alice could be really far away from Bob. Alice and Bob can be, you know, opposite sides of the planet, no problem. And Alice sets her polarizer vertically. And so half the time, Alice's photon gets through, in which case hers is vertical and Bob's is horizontal, and half the time Alice's photon is blocked, which means hers is horizontal and Bob's must be vertical. So what Bob sees is some photons coming with a probability 50% that it's vertical and 50% that it's horizontal. That's what happens if Alice arranges her polarizer this way. Well, suppose Alice instead uses a diagonal polarizer. Then what Bob gets is 50% diagonal one way and 50% diagonal the other way. Bob will see, we'll get two different things, it seems, if depending on what Alice sets her polarizer at. Bob is getting his photon maybe at the very moment that Alice is measuring her photon. The very same moment on opposite sides of the world. The effect is instantaneous. Okay? So, could we use this to send signals? You see, what Bob's got two situations he may be faced with. He may have the first situation or the second situation, and Alice controls which one of these Bob gets. All she has to do is move her polarizer this way, and immediately, right away, the photons that Bob is getting go from one situation to the other. The problem is that Bob can't tell these two situations apart. There's no device he can use to tell whether he's in the first situation or the second situation. Unless he had a perfect polarization analyzer. If he had a perfect polarization analyzer, then he would be able to tell which of these four polarizations he had. So given a perfect polarization analyzer, Alice can send Bob a message instantaneously, that is, faster than light. Uh-oh. So here's the story. If you had a quantum cloning machine, then you could have a perfect polarization analyzer. And if you had a perfect polarization analyzer, then you could send information faster than light. And if you could send information faster than light, then, using quantum entanglement, of course, then you could send information back in time. And if you can send information back in time, you run into the telegraph paradox. And maybe my grandfather is in danger. The thing that kept him alive is the impossibility of quantum cloning. If that's possible, everything follows. So in fact, not only is it all about information, it's all connected. It's all connected. I don't want to give you the idea that every impossible thing boils down to the telegraph paradox. Okay? There are a lot of them that do. So now for something completely different, I want to talk about bounded electromagnetic miracles. You see, every physical law suggests to us some impossible thing we might want to think about. Let's just violate the law. That's impossible. So what would happen? And so what I want to talk about is one of the great laws of physics. It's a conservation law. A conservation law says that something can't be created or destroyed. And the conservation law I want to talk about is the conservation of electric charge. Electric charge is a property of matter. There are positive charges and negative charges. Protons in the nucleus are positively charged. Electrons are negatively charged. Most matter has sort of zero net charge. But there's lots of positive charges and lots of negative charges out there. The law is that no process can create or destroy a net electric charge. That's the law. So first, before we try to break this law, let's understand the law a little better. And since we want to understand the law a little better, let's think about it in space-time. Okay? All right, so here's the space-time view. Remember, time points up, space is horizontal. So I've got space at one moment in time, space at a later moment in time, and so on. You could imagine taking a movie and then chopping an old-fashioned movie on film and then chopping the frames, cutting the frames apart and then stacking them up so that each frame is stacked on top of the next. That would be like space-time. Each frame would be space. The stack would be in the time direction. Okay, so here's a space-time view of things. And what I'm gonna consider is electric charges. So here's the world line of a unit electric charge. A charge turns out to come in discrete units. So here's a world line of a unit of electric charge. It happens to be a positive charge. Here it is. The charge is moving around a little bit. That's okay. The world line of a unit charge. That's how I'm going to draw a positive charge. But actually, charges can be positive or negative. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put arrows on the world line. Instead of making my arrows point to the future, I'm going to decide which way to point them based on whether it's a positive charge or a negative charge. So this is the world line of a positive charge, but this is the world line of a negative charge. The arrows point the other way. Am I saying that a negative charge is a positive charge going backward in time? Particle physicists sometimes speak in almost exactly those terms. But remember, I'm talking about electric charge, not information. So it's okay. All right. So that's a way you can speak, but don't take that too seriously. That's certainly the way we're going to draw it. And so if you created or destroyed an electric charge, that would mean that you'd have something that looked like this. Along would come a positive charge, and then poof, it's gone. The lines would just end. But that's not possible. Let's get rid of that. That's not possible. What kinds of things are possible? Well, you could have a positive charge and a negative charge come along and then meet and cancel each other out and get zero net charge. Sure, that's possible. Happens all the time. That doesn't violate the conservation of charge because you had positive charge and negative charge and they added up to zero. It's also possible you could start out with no charges and then sort of create a positive charge and a negative charge together. Notice what this looks like in the diagram. It looks like the line here just sort of bends around and goes backwards in time. But the line doesn't end. The line doesn't end. You can also have more complicated things coming along, and all these are possible processes for electric charges. The lines don't end. That's how to think about the conservation of charge in space-time. Okay, let's imagine a region of space-time, a certain region of space over a certain interval of time. Well, then, the conservation of charge amounts to this. The net number of charge lines that enter or leave a space-time region is zero. If a line enters, a line has to leave. And so I've got, let's see, how many go in? One, two, three, four, five. Five lines go in. How many leave? One, two, three, four, five. For every line that goes in, there's a line that goes out. That's the law of conservation of charge in the space-time view. Okay, so what I want to talk about are the field equations. It turns out that the electromagnetic field is governed by a set of equations. Electric and magnetic fields governed by a set of equations. These equations are the Maxwell equations, discovered about 1860 by the great Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell. And here they are. Dear to the hearts of every theoretical physicist, the Maxwell equations. They're kind of complicated. They're about electric and magnetic fields. The electric fields are E, the magnetic fields are B. And they're also about charges. This expresses how densely charges are distributed. This expresses how charges are flowing around. Pictures would be much nicer. So I'm going to draw a picture of each one of these Maxwell equations. Tell you what they mean. The first one means that we sometimes draw lines to illustrate the electric and magnetic fields. The electric field lines begin and end at electric charges. If you were to draw a picture of the electric field, the field lines that I might draw begin or end at the charges. But the second law tells me that magnetic field lines never begin or end. They loop around in closed loops, or they go on forever. They never begin or end. There are no endpoints to magnetic field lines. There are endpoints for electric field lines at charges. Okay, that's so far so good. Those are simple pictures. How about this one? This one tells me that that magnetic field lines tend to loop around electric currents or changing electric fields. Okay, that's what this one says. And this one tells me that electric fields tend to loop around changing magnetic fields, but they do it in the opposite direction. Notice that the lines go around the other way. That's this minus sign right there. Okay, so a picture of the Maxwell equations. Now you know electromagnetism. It's great. In fact, physicists think that these very beautiful, elegant equations are too messy. So it turns out that if you really know the language of relativity, you can take these four equations, or even eight equations, because each of these actually is shorthand for three different equations. Maxwell would have called this eight equations. You can take these equations and just write down two equations. Isn't that beautiful? These two equations are this one. And the other two equations are that one. The F and the star F describe the field. That's why they call it F. This thing is exactly the relativistic description of those lines of charge that I was talking about. This is all about the lines of charge. And here's the wonderful thing. If you start out with these equations, it's a wonderful fact. If you start out with these equations, you can prove the conservation of charge. The law of conservation of charge actually follows mathematically from the field equations. The way the charge is connected to the field guarantees that the charge is conserved. The field enforces conservation of charge. The field is responsible for conservation of charge. Okay, so if I want to create or destroy electric charge, remember we're talking about impossible things, then I'm going to have to violate the Maxwell equation somewhere. But let's not go overboard. We're going to allow a violation of Maxwell's equations, but let's not just allow every kind of violation. Let's bound things a little bit. Let's imagine that in a particular volume of space, say this room, over a particular interval of time, let's say 7 to 8 p.m. on Wednesday, we're allowed to violate the Maxwell equations. But at all other times and all other places, the Maxwell equations hold good. But we have a special dispensation for this period of time that we can violate them as much as we like. We can make the fields go any old way we want. We can make the charges go any old way. Charges will emerge from nowhere. Because, of course, if the Maxwell equations don't hold, conservation of charge goes away too. Okay? So this idea of having sort of a bounded holiday from physics is what we're going to call a bounded electromagnetic miracle. The Maxwell equations are true everywhere except in a limited region of space in a limited interval of time. Okay? So in space-time, there's some region of space-time. And that region could be thought of as a volume of space over an interval of time, right? Okay, there's this region, and Maxwell's equations hold everywhere outside the region, but inside the region, anything goes. I can create charge out of nothing. So here's my question. If I get to have a bounded electromagnetic miracle, can I wind up with more charge than I started with? I mean, inside the room, inside that hour, charges can just appear out of nowhere and disappear and do whatever I like. And so at the end of the day, when I have to go back to obeying the law, can I have some extra charge left over? In other words, is a bounded electromagnetic miracle enough to violate the conservation of charge outside? So no lines go into this region, but some lines come out. I wind up with, say, 3 positive charges left over. Why not? Why not? The remarkable answer is no. That can't happen. That the field enforces conservation of charge to the extent that because Maxwell's equations are true everywhere outside this region, the bounded electromagnetic miracle will not allow me to get some extra charge left over. There still have to be the same number of charge lines going into the region as come out of the region. That's interesting. That law of conservation of charge doesn't really depend on Maxwell's equations holding everywhere, because I could violate them in a small region and I'd never be able to tell as far as the conservation of charge is concerned. Okay. So why is this true? I could give you a mathematical argument. It would be unedifying. Actually, it's a very pretty argument, and it will have already occurred to most of the theoretical physicists in the room. But let's give the picture. Let's imagine you have an electric charge surrounded by a radial electric field. Okay? And now, that's the radial electric field if the charge is there. But suppose I take the charge and I move it. Well, then, the field changes. The field adjusts. but it doesn't adjust instantaneously. The adjustment sort of propagates outward. Out here, you still have the old field. The news can only go, after all, at the speed of light. In fact, this is what light is. The news can only propagate outward at the speed of light. And so out here, it's still where the field that you had when the particle was at its old position. Now the particle's at its new position in here, and in between, there's the adjustment. There's the disturbance in the field, the change in the field. But notice that the field in the region of the disturbance, that field is perpendicular to the direction of propagation. And the reason is that only transverse changes can propagate outward. Remember when I said that light, that the electromagnetic disturbance was in a direction perpendicular to the direction of motion? This is the same fact. It depends on Maxwell's equations. That only transverse disturbances can propagate. So what happens if we try to make charge from nowhere? Let's suppose we have no electromagnetic field, no electric field. And then suddenly a charge appears, and the universe tries to adjust. Sometimes later, the change in the E field is propagated outward to some region here, but now what happens? Now Maxwell's equations are true again. That first part was Maxwell's equations obviously weren't true, but now Maxwell's equations are true again. What happens now? Well, this field change is not transverse. The field change is trying to propagate in this direction, but it's a change from no field to a field in that direction. The change in the field is in the same direction that we want that change to propagate. And the field equations say that that kind of wave can't exist. That kind of disturbance can't propagate. So the field equations prevent the change from propagating outward. The information about the new charge cannot reach the outside world. And in fact, when we reimpose Maxwell's equations, we're going to have the accounts balanced, either by this stuff all going away or some negative charges appearing here or something. At the end of the day, this is going to have to obey Maxwell's equations too. So the reason that we can't violate the conservation of charge in a lasting way by a bounded electromagnetic miracle is that the information about the change in charge can't propagate outward. It's all about the information. So what's the moral of the story? Well, one moral, I think, is that I hope you have come to agree with me that thinking about impossible things is useful for understanding not just the shaky premises of science fiction movies, but also for thinking about the real world, the universe, as it really is, and the connections between physical laws, sometimes very surprising connections. But the real moral of the story is my favorite joke. And for those of you who have heard the joke before, because I know some of you have, I apologize, but I'm going to tell it again. Here's my favorite joke. My favorite joke concerns three guys who are sitting around, and they come to discuss what the most amazing invention in the world is. And the first guy says, I think it's the television. Why the television? Well, you look at the television and right there in your living room, you can see what's happening on the other side of the world. That's amazing. I think it's the most amazing invention ever. And the second guy says, that's pretty amazing. But I think it's the jet airplane. Because you get in a jet airplane, and in about a day, you can be on the other side of the world. You're not just seeing it, you're actually there. I think that's pretty amazing. So they turn to the third guy. They say, what do you think? He says, I don't want to say. He said, no, tell us. You'll think it's stupid. No, come on, tell us. He says, I think it's the thermos bottle. The thermos bottle? Why? He says, well, think about it. You put hot stuff in, it stays hot. You put cold stuff in, it stays cold. So how does it know? This is my favorite joke because I think the question, how does it know, is really one of the most fundamental questions in physics. I think increasingly we're looking at the world not simply in terms of exchanges of energy, but in terms of exchanges of information. The parts of the world are sending messages to each other. That's how it knows what to do. The parts of the universe are sending messages to each other. The universe is a gigantic information network. And the laws that govern the information network, that say what is possible and what is impossible about how information can move around and be processed in the universe, those laws are some of the most important laws there can be. And those are the laws that we're actually coming to understand right now. And with that, I thank you for coming.
I have a great interest in reading about cold fusion, and goodness knows we could use something like that right about now. So, is it possible or impossible?
It's possible. Most of our energy comes from fusion. The fusion just happens to be occurring in the center of the sun. That fusion reaction is contained by the gravitation of the sun, which is so big that the sun's sort of like a gigantic thermonuclear explosion that's so big it holds itself together by gravity. And most of our energy is either directly or indirectly from the energy we get from the sun. So it's possible. The technological question is whether we can make this happen on a smaller scale on the Earth in a way where we can recover the energy. That's a question. That's a question of whether it's feasible, really, rather than a question of whether it's possible in principle. That's a tremendously important question, in some ways more important than any question I considered this evening for the future of humanity. But it's more of an engineering question rather than a question of fundamental principle. But we know fusion's possible. It happens all the time. Just can we make it happen where we want it?
When you talk about time and a clock traveling at high speeds, time slows down.
Yeah.
Do we understand why that is, or do we just accept it? Because in my mind now, if we take the same two clocks that you use for the experiment, and one of them you froze to very, very low temperatures, you'd get the same effect. Ah. So surely the mechanism is the same.
Well, you know, that depends on how you build the clock. The effect that I'm talking about in relativity is an effect that is a universal principle. It doesn't depend on how you build the clock. That the same thing would be true if you made the clock by mechanical vibrations or by electrical oscillations or by some sort of atomic resonance or whatever. However you build the clock, the same effect takes place. But any sort of effect of temperature on a clock is quite different. So a low temperature might cause certain atomic processes to change, but you can have a really cold pendulum that swings back and forth just like a really warm pendulum. Because all that depends on is the local gravitational field, which is not dependent on gravity. So the clock effects in relativity are universal effects that affect every kind of clock, just as the principle of relativity affects every law of physics. And so the analogy is not exact. Now, as to why moving clocks run slowly, that's a really interesting question. We can give explanations for that in terms of other principles. And then you might ask, well, why are those principles true? Well, maybe we can give explanations of those in terms of yet other principles. But of course, this is like speaking to a three-year-old who, after every sentence, says, "Why?" Okay. There's no end to that. We can give a much more coherent account than I've given. It depends on some very simple properties of space and time, and you can derive the fact that moving clocks run slowly from these principles. And you can confirm it in the laboratory by looking at how far short-lived particles can go if you move them really fast. If they seem to last longer if you shoot them really fast. So we can appeal to principles and give an explanation that way, and we can see that it's true, beyond that, I'm not sure that we have a way of answering. Please, it'd be okay with me if you wanted to ask a follow-up. So,
on the matter of the elemental particles, lasting longer, mm-hmm. what you're basically saying is that they live longer.
Yeah,
that doesn't mean to say that the time is different.
Well, you know, if you had a bunch of them together, you could use them as a kind of clock. You know, I say, oh, geez, what time is it? How many particles do I have left? And that would tell you what time it is because their random decay follows a certain mathematical law in time. You could use radioisotope decay, which is basically the same kind of thing, as a kind of clock. It turns out that's not very practical because it's not very precise. But you can use it to make a clock. And anything that depends on time can be used as a clock. And every such thing obeys the principle of relativity.
I have one question concerning the speed of light. Is there such a particle called a tachyon particle, which actually they say should move faster than the speed of light, but they don't have something to measure it with? Could you tell me a little more about
that? So I may not be completely up to date on the subject of tachyons, but let me tell you what I know. Of course, with the idea that nothing can travel faster than light, you immediately say, well, if something did travel faster than light, is there a way to reconcile that with relativity? Maybe the telegraph paradox is somehow solvable. Let's set that aside. Can we make a description of this? And the kind of particle that would be a particle that would, unlike a regular particle like an electron, which can never travel even as fast as the speed of light, it's always slower than light, or a photon which traveled at the speed of light, a tachyon would always travel faster than light. It couldn't go slower. And you can work out some of the physics of them. The physics of tachyons is full of difficulties. Okay, starting with the causal paradox, the telegraph paradox that I mentioned. There are even other problems about the fact that there's no lowest energy level for tachyons. All kinds of terrible things. So consequently, when a particle theory comes along that seems to have tachyons in it for some reason, this is regarded as a blemish, and has to be dealt with. By seeing what the consequences of this are. In fact, in some theories, if you look at the mathematics in a certain way, it appears there are tachyons. But when you look at the mathematics in another way, you see, oh yes, those tachyons aren't really there. They're an artifact of the way we looked at the mathematics. Very often, the same mathematical theory has different, the same physical theory has different mathematical disguises, like that those big set of Maxwell's equations and those little bitty ones. And so sometimes it looks like there are tachyons in your theory, but there aren't really. Now, maybe our physics as we understand it is not exactly right. Maybe at the small scale, relativity is no good, and things become lots weirder and more complicated than we think. Maybe you could have tachyons that only exist for a very short time and only go a short distance. Maybe that's possible. But if your theory has tachyons in it, you have to explain why that doesn't get you in trouble. I guess what I'm trying to say. If your new idea about what physics might be has tachyons in it, then there's a paper to be written. Why these tachyons aren't a problem, okay? And that's what this argument tells you. Is that, I don't know if that's a good answer. There are people in the audience who know far more about this than I do. So I direct you to all of them.
Okay. Should I ask them to put their hand up then? One other question.
Yeah.
We're told that the speed of light is slowing down.
Well, sort of.
Okay, but
there's one theory is that maybe the speed of light is slowing down.
Okay.
That maybe the constants of nature aren't constant, or at least don't have constant relations to each other, and the net effect would be, in our measurements, the speed of light would look like it's slowing down. That's a speculative theory. That's not very well established.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.